This is Heather Sontag on October 18th, 2017, with an interview with Frank Clover on the Dow 50 anniversary.
And then,
you may start speaking. Introduce yourself, please.
So, Frank Clover, regular service with the history faculty 1966 to 2001. After being hired by the history department, I had this affiliations subsequently with the Department of Classics and the program in Integrated Liberal Studies, but this is history to start with and history all the way through.
And where were you on October 18th, 1967?
Teaching in Bascom Hall, right next to the building in which the Dow Chemical Company was holding interviews, and that was the center of the protest. It was known as the Commerce Building in those days, Ingram Hall these days.
And how did you become aware of these riots or the protests?
The noise. Bascom Hall was right next to Ingram Hall, what's known as Ingram Hall these days. And across the day, as the riots and the aftermath progressed, a fair amount of the action spilled over into Bascom Hall.
And by action, do you mean student action or enforcement that was called on campus to react?
Most of what I saw in Bascom Hall was students. The police line posted at the entrance to the, I'll still call it the comm building.
Mm-hmm, that's fine.
The police line remained, as I recall, pretty much stationary there. There was not so much police pursuit of individual protesters away from the line. So what I saw in Bascom Hall is mostly student student activity. At one point, I recall a student who had a certain amount of blood from an injury had either using a pocket knife or a screwdriver unscrewed the placard on the door of one of the administrators at the university. The Bascom Hall was sort of pledge center for the whole campus at the time, so that at least some of the lesser administrators had offices right there, and the student had just unscrewed the placard on the door of that particular official and was slipping the placard inside his coat. Incident and so forth sticks in mind. And another moment across the day, after I had met a class, I went over into a stairwell. Bascom Hall, of course, faces Ingram Hall, and there's a staircase right beside, which empties into an exits from Bascom Hall, exit into the parking lot. I think that parking lot is still right there. You get to the parking lot from Observatory Drive. I was on the second floor, just standing with a group of folks. This was mostly students, maybe one or two faculty as well. And one of these students says, "You know, this is happening at my university." And he was speaking with some considerable regret, and that sort of thing. Those are all kind of standout memories of the day. Understandably, it's kind of a confusing day, and somehow we all got home and that sort of thing. I don't recall that one, the end of the day so much. If it's okay, we'll talk about one of the immediate aftermaths, which was a meeting of the UW faculty. All university faculty. In those days, the faculty had just regular meetings, and most of the meetings were conducted in smaller rooms, and the attendance wasn't spectacular. Anybody on the faculty could attend. This was in the days before the UW faculty decided to create a faculty senate, where elected representatives from each department would come to faculty meetings, whether the business at hand was very boring or very interesting, there would be just kind of a regular attendance. But with a big event like this, the meeting was held in the theater, the Memorial Union, and the theater was pretty well packed. Quite a bit of the eventual direction of university attitude and disposition on the matter of protest against the war came into place, at least in initial form, at that meeting. The debate almost inevitably gravitated in the direction of a vote of confidence for the existing chancellor of the UW, who was in those days, from the Faculty of Sociology, William Sewell, the second. We'll keep track of these Sewells. His son, William Sewell III, a contemporary of mine from student days. William Sewell II was quite open himself in his opposition to the war. And so he was torn between the violence that erupted on the one hand and the real concerns of quite a number of people of the Vietnam War on the other. As I recall, I think that he did get a voter confidence. This was with an immense amount of debate. The faculty was quite divided in its opinions, in the plural, over the riot itself, the causes thereof, and that kind of thing. But relatively soon after that particular meeting, William Sewell stepped aside, and in his place, from the economics department, I think it was, Edwin Young became the chancellor. This by spring of '68 or thereabouts, and Edwin Young took a harder stance toward protests and that sort of thing. So that's some of the immediate consequences of the riot.
And you were mentioning that this day 50 years ago set off our repercussions of activity on campus, making university stand out in the nation for various reasons. Do you want to comment further on that?
Oh, yeah. And I'll try to keep a memory, because of all people, are going to bring a humorous columnist, Art Buchwald, into play here too. The appointment of Edwin Young as the chancellor. Edwin Young had, as I recall, some skill as a labor negotiator, and he employed those skills in negotiations with students who were some of them bent on just plain old disrupting the whole campus. A common chant among the most enthusiastic of protesters in protest in those days is "On strike, shut it down." And it, in that instance, was it shut the whole university down. And so Ed Young's always basically would not negotiate with the students, and this tough stance led in January of '69 to a full-scale protest, and that one, the circumstances, the violence was not just restricted to the exterior of the Commerce Building, as was the case with the Dow riots in '67. It was in various locations in the campus, barricades constructed, fire set, that sort of thing. And so rather quickly, the Wisconsin National Guard was on campus for about a week or so, working in tandem with the Madison police, and the presence of the National Guard was eventually calming. And I mean, there they were, and it did have a calming effect. So that particular riot simmered down. That's January of '69. The next really noticeable one first week of May of 1970, protests all across the country when President Nixon moved troops into Cambodia, thus expanding the Vietnam War. And the Wisconsin National Guard was once again present for about a week during some rather serious rioting, barricades, good weather, January of 69, it's cold outside. The first week of May, it was nice and warm, and the National Guard was present for about a week, and things settled down after that. There are further consequences, but that's far enough to go. The reason I mentioned that I'm going to bring Art Buchwald into play. Art Buchwald was a columnist who placed his humorous reflections on all sorts of things in various newspapers, including the Wisconsin State Journal. And somewhere in the midst of this, I think this was after the bigger explosion, the riots of January of 69, he placed a column in which two parents are expressing deep regret that their son was going off to combat, and so Art, injecting himself into this imaginary circumstance, asked the distraught parents, "Well, did he volunteer for service in the Marines?" "No," said the parents. "He got admitted to the University of Wisconsin, he wants to go there and get in on the campus rumpus and so forth." And Art Buchwald concludes the imaginary circumstance by saying that he knows somebody in night school there, and he can probably get the kid enrolled in night school where the rioting is less likely to occur and that sort of thing. So we were famous all over. Of course, lots of other campuses by that time. The relatively restrained appearance of the National Guard the first week of May of 1970 is the very same time that at Kent State University, the National Guard, which had been overworked by appearances at more than one campus, fired on the crowd, and there were fatalities and that kind of thing.
If we may back up to this day 50 years ago, and maybe the subsequent semesters until 69, what was it like to be a faculty member and teach and try to resume any kind of normalcy? Was that possible on campus? You had a job to do, right? To teach the students. But in this environment, I can only imagine it would have been difficult or distracting.
Yeah. The fall of 67, the riot came and went. And I don't recall for either the fall semester of 66, the fall semester of 67, 68, or the spring, that would be 1968, that there was much disorder built into the instruction. Over the spring of 68, across the summer of 68, the most radical of the students worked out plans to galvanize individual departments into action against the war, and as these departments took their own action against the war, so the protest would build. And by the fall of 68 and into spring of 69, disruptions of individual classes became rather common. Not just at UW, this was all across the country, and in the bigger high-profile campuses. Columbia University had its troubles, University of California, Berkeley had its troubles, so we were not unique at all. But there were built-in disruptions of classes by that time. And in the fall of 68, the introductory course I was teaching, this was the first semester of a two-semester survey of the ancient Mediterranean. We would spend the first term dealing with the very old Near East, the Egyptian pharaohs, that sort of thing. And then toward the end of the semester, we'd be dealing with the ancient Greeks. And this was a pretty sizable course. Let's say the student enrollment there was approximately 200 or something of the sort. And for a while, I did have some very rocky times. I remember one point where an outsider, I was lecturing, and the outsider just barged down to the front of the room and said, "Everybody is bored. Why don't you just stop talking and leave?" And there was a rocky moment where I wasn't quite sure what was going to happen next. And then the students started hollering at the intruder, "Get the hell out." And so the guy just wheeled about and headed out of the classroom. He evidently had one or two henchmen in the back of the room back him up, and one of the students in the class who was on the football team picked up one of the henchmen and just bodily threw him out of the classroom. There was plenty of, after the class was over, folks coming down and says, "What's going to happen next?" And boy, this is a mess, and all of that sort of thing. And one of the not the chancellor, but a university backup university administrator appeared in the back of the room, and I signaled to him, and we went and chatted for a little bit afterwards. And I, in chatting with the administrator, I allowed us how the disruption of history 111 was probably low on the priorities of the students in those days. Were outraged at just a whole bunch of things at once, and they kept moving to protest against this and this and this and this. And so I didn't think that that particular protest right in the course was going to last, and it didn't. But it was sure interesting while it did.
Well, I thank you for these stories. Is there anything else you'd like to add, the way this anniversary being marked, reflecting on it, shaped your life in the last 50 years?
A couple of things. The students had, in the midst of their protests, the ones that focused on the courses I was teaching, did have a number of really substantial causes to be not so happy with the way instruction was going at the university. The universities all across the country grew in leaps and bounds during the 1960s, and universities were slow to catch up to the doubling in size. I was an undergraduate at UW, 58 to 62. UW in those days, 20,000 or thereabouts. When I came on board the faculty in 66, the UW was just about double that size. Any institution can't keep up with a big change like that instantaneously, and teaching a course in which the multiple interests of the students has at least given some attention is a challenge. And over the years afterwards, I slowly, not instantaneously, put into place various options. Some students might be interested in acquitting most of the course by doing a research paper instead of taking a bunch of exams. How do you put in a structure that both those interests would be accommodated? It could be, and I spent the rest of the time I was teaching working on that, maybe with a certain amount of success. At least I hope so. So there was that. At the Dow riots in 67, during the riot of January 69, during the riot of first week of May 1970, I was quite puzzled and never then completely figured out what was going on. Since then, I got some suspicions that a lot of this had to do with the the structure of the U.S. government at the time. In the latter 1960s, before the election of Richard Nixon as president, which he took over, and he's elected in 68, took over in January of 69, his administration and subsequent administrations were a fair amount less left-oriented than the government of the U.S. from the election of John Kennedy in 1960 through the whole decade. Lyndon Johnson carrying on a progressive program in the same vein, in many instances much more enthusiastically. I have a hunch that the left leaning of the U.S. government brought out expectations on the part of a lot of progressives in the country. Boy, we're starting to get some progress here. Let's get more. Impatience with more progress not coming as quickly as anticipated, I think, is one of the basic factors behind the whole protest situation in the latter part of the 1960s.
All right. Well, would you like to conclude this in oral history or add anything more?
Oh, I think that's probably a bunch right there.
Yeah, it's great. And we really appreciate your coming in today.